spend time there again, to study there again. And this, I don't know, this sounds like a strange phrase, but when he died, this popped into my head that he's one of the few people, maybe the only person I've ever met in my life, that one day, many, many years from now, I'll be proud to tell my grandchildren that this was a man that I knew. And at his funeral 6 months ago, about 3,000 people turned up in Jerusalem. At a memorial service in London, about 60 people turned up. And I said a small thing then that the tragedy is that 200,000 people didn't turn up in Israel and that 600 people didn't turn up in London. For the reason being that I think that his life and his example and his teachings were really of crucial significance for our day and for our generation. And I only hope and pray that with the years after his passing, much of his spirit, much of his teaching, much of his, maybe his sort of world view, or maybe just his sort of presence of mind will become more diffused and spread amongst our people. So with that, let me start. And a slight thing, like I said about the title, it was entitled An Alternative Religious Zionism, which obviously puts the emphasis, the burden on the political, on the modern day debates in Israel. And it very much is going to be that. But I realised as I began to prepare the session that if I only focused on the political, I wouldn't be giving you a true picture of who Rav Amital was. There were a lot of obituaries after his death that said, maverick rabbi who supported a two-state solution, who wanted peace with the Arabs, dies age 86. Which to any student of his is a great tragedy for an obituary because he was just so much more than this. That's the first point, and connected to this really is I don't think you can really understand his politics if you don't understand his broader view, his broader perspective that he was coming from. So that's what I want to start with. So if you like, I'm going to flip the title and the subtitle around. I see reinforcements of source sheets have arrived. Can you put your hands up if you don't have source sheets? I'll take it as a compliment.
They're in a full section. So this lot, it's page 1 and 2, then page 3 and 4, so you need to pick 2 pages off the top, and then page 5 is here separately.
I'll let you guys figure that out. So I want to start with a broad introduction to who he was. If you want to read something whilst I'm speaking, or listen to me, a biography of Rav Amital is on page 5, and hopefully it will serve as a good introduction for those that will need it. So, like I said, his politics, which will be our focus, I really think stems from primarily his personality, which was that of a religious leader, a teacher of Torah, a head of a yeshiva. And he had his positions, which, cometh the hour, cometh the man, resulted in certain political positions. I will start with something perhaps a surprising source. It's a Rashi, a comment of Rashi on Yechezkel, on Ezekiel, which was obviously written around 900 years before Rav Amital was born, but there's quite a good reason for this. In the middle of Ezekiel, the prophet suddenly starts talking about three men. He says they are to be greatly praised. And these men, at first glance, don't seem to have anything to do with one another. They are all biblical characters. The first one is Noah, the second one is Daniel, the third one is Enoch, or Job. All people living in very different geographical locations, different times, very different lives. What do they have in common with one another? The Midrash, which Rashi quotes, sums it up very nicely. This is the first source. Lefisha elu shlosha, because these three people, ra'u shlosha olamot, they saw three worlds. Ra'a ha'olam banui, they saw a world built. Olam chavav, a world destroyed, but olam banui, and a world rebuilt. And this was a phrase which Rav Amital actually associated with himself. Everything that we're going to say about who he was and his teachings is very much, if you can call it almost an autobiographical theology. All his thoughts stem from his life. He was born in Hungary in 1924, and Hungary, without getting into the whole history of it, was really, especially the area he was born in, not one which had come much into contact with the Enlightenment, with the West. It was still a very classical, traditional Jewish life he grew up in, an area whole generations steeped in Torah, without much access to the wider world and its currents. He only had 4 years of secular education. The vast majority of his time was spent in the classical yeshivot of Europe, and he was very much steeped in this and continued to be so to be throughout his life. He would often tell us about experiences and memories of the great giants of pre-war Europe that he had met. There were certain things that he wished to institute, even certain tunes that were sung in the great yeshivas Balozhin in the 19th and early 20th century, which we sang, which is very much of Amital bringing the world of old Europe to modern Israel. That was the world in which he grew up. At his 80th birthday party, I was in Israel during his 80th, the Chinese year of Rav Amital's birthday. I don't know if anybody else was there. And he had various birthday parties, which was a wonderful opportunity for fundraising to be done, etc. And he joked that perhaps at his 81st birthday, they'll stop making him 80th birthday parties. But one of the big ones in Binyanei HaOma in Jerusalem, he said that when he was 7 years old, he'd had a dream of an enormous ball of fire approaching the tree that was in their village, and was approaching very, very slowly and brightening up the world. And the 6 or 7 year old Yehuda Amital, or Yehuda Kain, as his name was at the time, was convinced that this was Moshiach coming, and he convinced his classmates to dance around the tree and to welcome it. This was a man with a hugely powerful imagination. Sadly, as we know, this wasn't Moshiach coming. The very opposite was in fact happening, and the Holocaust and everything that came with it swept into his world. He was taken to a labor camp. The rest of his family, Egypt family, was deported to Auschwitz, where they were all immediately killed upon arrival. Hungary was one of the last areas to be affected by the Holocaust. A much higher percentage of Holocaust survivors are from Hungary, because the Germans only arrived there somewhat later. And we're not going to talk, you know, there are whole sections that could easily be given, of Rav Amital's thought that could easily be given an hour's session on, so we're not really going to talk about his Holocaust theology. I just want to mention one thing that might be worth saying in this regard, that it clearly influenced him very much, this world destroyed that he saw and influenced the person he became. But it was also, he also has a very, before we went to Poland, he told a small group of us that when people asked him after the Holocaust, or during the Holocaust, how he maintained his faith, and his faith which very much nourished him through the Holocaust, he gave an answer which I think is quite revealing of who he was. He said, "And would it be any easier if I were to be secular?" And to be a bit careful, I'm sure many of us are familiar with what's become known as the chief rabbi's answer to this question. The question isn't where was God at Auschwitz, it's where was man at Auschwitz. The difference, there's a very important difference between these two answers. Rami Tal's answer is not a philosophical answer. It's not to where was the man, where's this great idea of man. It's a question of, you know, me coping with my world, me as a human being. Is Auschwitz any easier to understand if God isn't in the picture? I don't think so. And this is just a very small sort of glimpse into him. 1944, the camps are liberated, and he effectively, he and a group of friends, they go back to their town, which is more or less destroyed. A small group of them spend Yom Kippur in the house in which he'd grown up. They have a single machzorah between them, which they pray from. He says that his concept of prayer for the rest of his life came from this single Yom Kippur. And from there on, they set out to Palestine. And he's told us that Hanukkah of 1944, they lit the candles, each candle each night, they lit in a different port. One night in Hungary, by like night seven, they were in Istanbul. And finally, on the last night, they arrived in Israel. There he resumes his studies in the Hebron Yeshiva in Jerusalem, one of the great institutions of the Haredi world. But to give you a brief insight into how Israel at that time was far less divided, far less divisioned up amongst different denominations, it was a no-brainer for him that he would join the Haganah when the time came and fought in the War of Independence. After the war, he continues his studies. He becomes, he gets his smicha, his rabbinic ordination from Rav Issachar Zalman Meltzer, and he becomes a teacher at a place called Yeshivat Hadaron. It's one of the early yeshivot in the new state. And interestingly, one of his classmates, one of the co-people on the sevet, on the teaching team, there is somebody else people might have heard of, a man called Rabbi Eliezer Menachem Shach, who goes on to be the great ideologue of Haredi Israel after the Hazanish has died. And I always like thinking of these sort of historical quirks, that the two men both teaching in adjoining rooms in 1948, 1949, presumably sharing rather a lot amongst themselves, go off, you know, two rockets a millimetre apart at the start, go off in such completely opposite directions, become two of the leading forces in their respective areas of Israeli society. He's become very much under the influence of Rav Kook, of religious Zionism at this time, and is concerned that those who wish to spend time in the yeshiva world studying Torah will inevitably create discord or feelings that from the secular public that they are shirking their other wider responsibilities to the state. And so from this part of a group from which the idea of Hesder emerges, Hesder, which is the idea of combining military service and Torah study so that it won't be like the classical Haredi model of just being completely exempt from national service, but it will be a five-year program of an integrated army and yeshiva study. I'm giving this as a very brief introduction, but it's going to serve as the broader canvas on which we're going to paint his thought. Comes 1967, and Israel obviously attains control of a far larger territory than it's ever had before. And it's worth using the idea of an academic that some of you may be familiar with, a wonderful man called Professor Aviezer Ravitsky, who characterizes it like this. The religious Zionist public during the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s had felt quite disenfranchised. The religious had always had the monopoly on Jewish leadership. It's any point in Jewish history which you can highlight, whoever has been the leader has been somebody from the religious camp. Suddenly secular Zionism explodes onto the scene, and the religious, this is Ravitsky's phrase, are pushed into the passenger carriage of the train, whilst the secular Zionists take control. And they've got the kibbutz movement and everything that comes from that. With 1967, suddenly the religious Zionist movement sees itself as having the opportunity of now taking control of the driving seat. Secular Zionism, to a certain extent, is running out of steam in terms of its real passionate chalutzim, its pioneers, and religious Zionism by this point has generated a significant mass who are willing to take advantage of this new situation. And this is where what we now call the settlement movement originally comes from, and the great idea being that now we are going to be this new stage of settling Israel, this new stage of development. And of course, all the connotations which we associate with the settlement movement and etc., etc., we have to understand this coming later on in the story. At this point in time, this is all very fresh, this is all very new, this is all very exciting. And the religious Zionist world jumped for this. And Rav Amital was actually the first person to do this in this story. The first settlement over the Green Line after 1967 is a place called Alon Shavut, which literally translates as return to the oak tree. It was the site of an original settlement there prior to 1947, which the Gush Etzion block, which was very sadly besieged and cut off from the main part of Israel, and the people who lived on the kibbutzim and a group of Palmach fighters were massacred there by the Jordanian army, and there was an oak tree there which the families of the people who'd been massacred there would look at from Jerusalem the 19 years in between 1948 and 1967. They'd remember it. And so the first settlement after 1967 was Alon Shavut, the return to the oak tree. And Rav Amital was at the head of this with a small group of other people to found a new settlement with a yeshiva there, which would be part of it. And this is a crucial stage in the journey and the development of religious Zionism. And so Yeshivat Har Etzion, which I am somewhat biased towards, having spent 3 years there, I recognize at least one of the faces who spent time there, becomes a very big and important institution within the Hesder world and the world of Yeshivot, which combine army study with Torah learning. It gets a very good reputation. It becomes quite a flagship place. To run forward and just skip up a lot of simplified things, by the 1980s, things are taking a rather different turn. There's the war in Lebanon, things don't seem to be quite panning out in the messianic way in which religious Zionism's original founders had envisaged. And Rav Amital becomes quite disillusioned with the mainstream of what's called Gush Emunim. Some of you may be familiar with the Greater Israel Project, which sees the ideas of land, of settlement, of the messianic process, all as coterminous with one another. He becomes much more sceptical about this. He comes out against the mainstream of the religious science body, in fact, really even against mainstream Israel at this time, and criticizing what's happening up in Lebanon at this time. Sabra and Shatila for him is the greatest Hillel Hashem that has ever happened, the greatest desecration of God's name in recent history. Chaim Vermant, the Anglo-Jewry's greatest ever journalist, had a wonderful phrase that Amital's conversion on the road to Damascus was on the road to Beirut, which I thought was a very neat way of putting it. He founds Meimad, which is an alternative to the mainstream religious Zionist party. Meimad literally translates in Hebrew as perspective. He wishes a new perspective to be shared on the relationship between what it means to be Jewish, what it means to be Israeli, the role of religion in the public sphere in Israel. Meimad is not that successful electorally. Great tragedy that it is. He remains as Rosh Yeshiva at this time, as the head of the institute. Of course, 1995, the greatest tragedy in modern Israeli society happens, and Yitzhak Rabin is assassinated. It's a terrible time. A friend of mine, quite a few years older than me, put it this way to me, that in the aftermath of Rabin's assassination, if you were wearing a kippah and walking down the street, people would cross over to the other side. Tensions between religious and secular were so terrible at that point in time. Rav Amital is already a member of Knesset, is brought in to be a cabinet member, minister without portfolio in Peres' government, with ideally the idea of being a bridge between religious and secular at this very terrible moment. A few years after this, Rav Amital decides that politics, day-to-day politics, is no longer for him, and he moves back to the yeshiva, and he spends his last, the last 14 years really, really back at the yeshiva, giving classical. He'll talk about his philosophy, his politics, etc., but his bread and butter, his day-to-day, was classical yeshiva study, the Masechtot, the tractates of Talmud that have been learned for hundreds of years. Teaching in the yeshiva, I arrived in 2004 and got my first taste of him in 2008, 2009, 2010. Being a senior person, I got to sit right at the front of the Beit Midrash, which meant that when he was there, I was the person right next to him speaking, and he was quite frail at this time. I would be able to... if his microphone fell off, I would help it. I would put it back on. I would help him back to the seat. And this might sound like very small, nonsense type things. For me, it was very important. And having painted this backdrop, I want to share something of him with you to fill in the details and the context of this, as it were. So, like I said, in order to get a grip on him, you really can't start with the politics. You have to start with something of his overall religious, spiritual. Worldview. And hopefully within that we'll be able to draw out some general points from which the whole political idea will make a lot more sense. And I thought it's best to start with a story that anybody who has ever been to Yeshivat Har Etzion Gush has had smacked over their head millions of times. Anybody who knows it would appreciate this. This is the story of the baby crying. And this is the story that Rav Amital must have repeated hundreds and hundreds of times over the years, and it was said to be the founding idea, as it were, on which he wanted his yeshiva to be built. It's source two, but I'm not going to read the source inside. I'll tell it over on the outside. The story is told of the Alter Rebbe, one of the first Rebbes of Lubavitch, what goes on to be the dynasty of Lubavitch, and he's learning Torah, studying by himself in his room. His son, or perhaps son-in-law, is studying in the next room. And whilst in the midst of his studies, he is disturbed by the cry of a baby. And it is his grandson who is screaming in his cot. He goes up, leaves the room, leaves his book, goes and picks up the baby from the crib, cuddles him, soothes him, nurses him back to sleep, and puts him back and walks back. And he sees his son, or son-in-law, I've forgotten which one, and sees him still sitting there, deeply immersed in his page of Talmud, and stands shocked in front of him and says, "What on earth are you doing? How did you not get up to comfort your child?" To which the reply comes, "I was just so immersed in my study, I didn't hear it. It passed me over. It was outside of my field of consciousness." And perhaps at this point I'll cut to the text, just towards the end of the first paragraph. The Rebbe then declared, if somebody is studying Torah and fails to hear the cry of a Jewish baby, there is something very, very wrong with his learning. Now, presumably this was meant in the localized, specific location of this room in the small town of Lubavitch in Ukraine or Russia or wherever it is. But Rav Amital, as was his wont with certain texts, drew a far larger message from that and really expanded the idea of baby and the idea of crying to a far wider, a far larger application, and felt that in every, if we who are involved in what we see as the classical text, the central tenets, the important ideas of our people, of our religion, are unaware, are so involved in ourselves that we are closed off to crying in the widest possible sense of what's going on in our society, then there is something very, very wrong with us and something very, very wrong with society. If we are so immersed in what we see as our métier, then there is something gone deeply wrong. I think, of course, he meant it, he was talking specifically to his yeshiva, to the religious Zionist public, but I think, of course, the message can be applied to any denomination which is so focused in on itself that it completely does not hear anything of wider society, then we've reached a sorry situation. A passage by, I'm sure, a person that many people in this room love, David Grossman. I'm reminded of the passage that I think this is in the Dispatches over 10 years, small pieces of journalism. People know it?
Yellow wing.
Yellow wing. Or on a knife?
Bird on a wire?
Right. Yes, thank you, Paul. Bird on a wire. He says that, in his introduction to it, he says, all of Israeli society, every group in Israeli society considers itself to be a persecuted minority. The Russians think they're a persecuted minority. The ultra-Orthodox think they're a persecuted minority. The secular think they're a persecuted minority. The Sephardim do, etc. Everybody, it's a whole group of bubbles that think of themselves as persecuted minorities. And this idea of the hearing the baby's cry, I guess, is meant as a one blow, at least, in the war against in a war against that. And this was the message that is pounded into us time after time, with the danger of becoming a cliche, obviously. We joke about it, but I think it's a very important starting off lesson when talking about this issue. The next thing I want to point out is what you might call, maybe this really is getting into theology. It's a general question in Jewish philosophy, Jewish thought. What is the role, what is the place of morality in the place of ethics, the place of subjectivity within within Jewish consciousness? And one typical go-to answer has, of course, been halakha. Jewish law is what defines Judaism. It's characterized by its law, and it's the bedrock of all Jewish thought. And you can hear this in many very, very well-respected and great Jewish authorities of the past, of the present. Rav Amital very much disagreed with this. Of course, not to mean that halakha wasn't very much part of his world. It absolutely was. But he thought it absolutely was not the sole source. Maybe he didn't even think it was the source of our ethical sensitivity. I phrase it quite strongly and think that he did not think that halakha was the source from which we draw our ethical considerations. Rav Amital had not gone to university, he hadn't studied anthropology, he hadn't learned that morality is something completely culturally bound and there's nothing objective about morality. And it's a good thing he hadn't learned that, I think, and it's a great benefit we get from that, because Rami Tal was convinced there was something naturally deeply rooted within us, within man, in his own individual way, that he can know that which is right. And he would draw from the whole classical collection of Jewish sources based originally on the verse of Va'asita ha-yashar v'hatov, you shall do the straight, the correct, and the good, without any reference to any specific law, the natural intuition of every single individual to know that which is right. Perhaps I'll read source 3. God created man in his image, but senem demut vara uto, endowing him with moral sensitivity and a conscience. In other words, with natural morality. This sensitivity has characterized man ever since the world was created. Even when it did not stem from a direct divine command, God addresses man through his conscience and morals. This is the implication of the following Gemara. It's a very well-known and beautiful Gemara. Rabbi Yochanan said, had the Torah not been given, We would have learnt modesty from the cat, aversion to theft from the ant, chastity from the dove, and conjugal manners from the fowl. It's a lovely piece of Chazal to see the way in which they think, the way in which they look at the world. But the main point is very clear. You do not need the Torah, you do not need Halakha, you do not need the Shulchan Aruch, in order to tell you how to be a good person. And woe betide any person who only bases his moral sensitivity upon those sources. You need to look deep inside yourself and ask yourself whether or not a certain course of action, even if it seems to be mandated by classical religious sources, seems to you to be correct. And Rav Amital, and this is, I don't want to get too much into areas of theology, has what, if you like, you can call a dual-track approach to theology, Jewish theology. On the one hand, there is the halakha, the divine commands from God, which certainly form the structure of our world and are absolutely central in themselves, but at the same time, and not dependent on, not subservient to, is our own natural intuition of what morality should be. And these things should never, one should never be evil. Both should be given absolute priority, and one should not take precedence immediately over the other. And this perhaps leads me to a very famous story, another one which any person who's ever spent any time in Yeshiva Haaretz Zion is familiar with. What happens when these two tracks clash with one another? Then what seems to be the demands of the halakha goes very much against what our natural intuitions of what is correct, what should be done. What happens when these two clash? And so it sounds like a classical yeshiva question, the one I'm about to say, one which might have some roots in certain sources but has no practical ramifications, but we'll talk about it anyway because it expresses it very well. It seems in, if you don't mind me getting a bit halachic for a second, many of you will hopefully be familiar with, there are two levels of Jewish law. There's Doraita, the Rabbanan, biblical law, and rabbinic law. Biblical law will always take precedence over rabbinic law if there is a clash. Now, as you all know, eating pig is the classic example of something which is biblically proscribed. If you're a non-Jew and you don't know anything about Judaism, you know that Jews can't eat pork. However, it comes as somewhat of a surprise, perhaps, to see that there is no biblical commandment whatsoever against eating human flesh, not against cannibalism. I don't mean about killing humans, I mean about eating human flesh once the person has died. There's no command against it whatsoever. It does not appear in the Torah. Some people don't even think it's a rabbinic prohibition. Some people do think it's a rabbinic prohibition. In any case, it clearly is not on the same halakhic level as the prohibition of eating, just for argument's sake, pork. And so the question arises, and was asked to Rav Amital, if somebody finds himself in the terribly tragic situation, the proverbial desert island, you have crashed, and all you have on that desert island is seared human flesh or these wild boars running around the island, which one should you do? Of course, the halakha seems to be quite clear on it. The biblical command says that you cannot eat pork. The Bible has nothing to say whatsoever about eating human flesh. Ergo, you should eat the human flesh. Now, Rav Amital replied without a moment's hesitation that one who eats human flesh, or even thinks he should eat human flesh, is completely not understood what the Bible is about. The Bible did not prescribe that eat cannibalism, for argument's sake, simply because it never thought the idea would occur. The idea is so repugnant, so repulsive to what is just a basic sense of morality, the Torah has no need to prescribe it. And of course, absolutely, one should eat anything other than the human flesh. Just to read the second paragraph of source number 4, it seems obvious to me that God does not want man to eat human flesh. The Torah fails to mention that the eating of human flesh is forbidden, not because it is permitted, but because certain things are so obvious that it is unnecessary for the Torah to say. Now, I should point out this is not necessarily an obvious opinion. Other people have said that you should eat human flesh, but then you should do teshuva. You should do repentance for having violated biblical command. I don't know if anyone says you should eat human flesh. You should eat the pork, but then do teshuva to repentance for having violated the biblical command. For Rav Amital, you haven't done anything wrong whatsoever. It could not be. If there is a clash between halakha and what is clear, objective, morality, then some form of compromise has to be worked out between them, or, if in extreme cases, your natural moral inclination certainly needs to take precedence. I'm going to just do a very brief aside at this point, unless you think that the example that we have just discussed is so abstruse, so academic, so really would never happen as to not even be worthy of consideration. I'd like to show you a very tragic source which does indeed bring the idea of humans eating humans up. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with something called Shut Mimamakim. It means a response from the depths. A man named Rabbi Ephraim Oshry, I believe he was in Warsaw, I could be wrong. The rabbi in Warsaw, both before and during the Second World War, and as it were, was one of the rabbis of the Warsaw ghetto, and has just, people would write, even in the midst of the most terrible persecution imaginable, was asked certain questions that you could never imagine occurring, questions that should never have to be asked. And it's a work which I highly recommend for anybody interested in the Holocaust, interested in response literature, interested in Judaism during the Holocaust, and it's a wonderful and very tragic work. But he has this very striking piece. Quotes the verse, and in Israel is his pride, and the people of Israel is God's pride. This is source number 5, the bottom of page 1. In Israel is his pride, and rightfully so. But the severity of the hunger that prevailed in the Jewish detention camps during the Holocaust was unimaginable and indescribable. And hunger is the greatest affliction of all. But the Jews never fell from their holiness, the holiness of man, and never ate human flesh. For we know what is stated in the Torah, and you shall be holy men to me, Anshei Kodesh Tikyun Li. And I think, this is a source worthy of knowledge in its own right, but it's also worthy of talking about in the context of Rav Amital, as I alluded to at the beginning. Rav Amital was a person who was very much forged in the Holocaust. You can see his life as very much, if you like, a response to the Holocaust, rebuilding the world after seeing a world that has been destroyed, to go back to the source that we started with. And so the idea of, the essentialness of ethical sensitivity, the essentialness of having one's morality in the place of one's religious worldview, is forged out of this terrible historical occurrence. Perhaps I can also just jump from the source we just read and launch from that into another line of Rav Amital's thought. The last verse quoted was, "And you shall be holy men to me, Anshei Kodesh Tikyun Li." There is an idea of the Kotzker Rebbe, one of the great Hasidic Rebbes, although Kotzker was a very different brand of Hasidut to the rest, a very lovely idea on this verse, which Rav Amital was wont to quote the whole time. The verse in Hebrew is, "Anshei Kodesh Tihyun Li," holy men, holy people you shall be for me. The Kotzker said, God says, I want you to be holy people. Angels, I have enough of them. I've got enough holy angels up in heaven. I have no need whatsoever for you to be angels. What I want you to be is holiness, holy people as people, holy as man, in your humanity. Be men, be holy to me. And the idea of finding an idea of a very human way, not trying to leave this world, but trying to bring ethics, sanctity, religiosity into the human condition, was something that characterized Rav Amital his whole life. You'll notice that none of these sources are academic. None of them are complicated, Kantian-type concepts. They're all simple ideas, not because he's talking down, but because he was a simple ish Yehudi. He described the wonderful Haaretz article on him in 1995. The title of the article was "The Simple Jew," and in many ways this is exactly what he was. A man, strive to be a man in the simplest sense. This is a book where most of the quotes are from. Haaretz Natan Livnei Adam is the Hebrew version of it. The earth was given to man. It's a quote from Tehillim, I believe, from Psalms, and it very much in line sums up, if you like, what he was about. The world is given to man. The idea of the divine hovers in the world, but it is for us to to creator. This idea of us as humans is central to Ravanikala's thought. And perhaps as a final idea before we get into the politics, as it were, of it, is to talk about distinction, being able to distinguish between, not just between texts and law versus morality, but even within the classical corpus of what is Jewish thought, what is Jewish existence. So I'll just read the first line of source number 6. The gradation of mitzvot is of paramount significance. Mitzvot, commandments, and let's even expand it to broader concepts within Judaism, are not of equal value. There is not an equality of ideas within Judaism. One has to learn, it's a crucial skill to develop, to learn how to discriminate between ideas in Judaism, and to know that which is truly central, that which we need to sacrifice things for, versus that which is of importance, of significance, but certainly does not exist at the centre of our picture. It exists, if you like, in a very mundane halachic example. The Shulchan Aruch says you need to say the recitation of the Shema on time in the morning. He also says that you should put on your right shoe before your left shoe, and do up your left shoe before your right shoe. And as a clash between these two, you realise you put your shoes on in the wrong order, but it's the time to say Shema. Rabbi Tal used this as a very simple, almost simplistic example. Let's not be fooled there. Let's not try and get into any sort of conundrum. It's quite clear which one takes precedence, and it's not which order should I do my shoes up. And starting with this very simple point, a very, very crucial point, and one which will play into the politics that we're going to discuss, emerges. Let's read the last paragraph of source number 6. The halachot recorded in the Shulchan Aruch are also not all on the same level. Someone who relates to all the mitzvot as having equal importance is liable to fall into serious error. We learn from Chazal that in the clash between the Jewish people and the land of Israel, it is the Jewish people who take precedence. Now that is an enormous line, a line which is certainly hard to read upon. Some people wouldn't even like to formulate it because it raises certain problems for their worldview, but one which became a very important line in Ravanikala's thoughts. And let's bridge the gap from the thought into the politics with this idea. Ravanikala had a very simple formula. In the classical Cookian, that means where cooks thought of the world, horrible word, right? Cookian, some words shouldn't be said. There are three central concepts. If anybody has ever been to any B'nai Akiva meeting, they will know it. Eretz Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Al Pi Torah Yisrael. The land of Israel, the people of Israel, by the Torah of Israel. These three concepts, very important concepts, the pillars of what religious Zionism is, but of course there are going to be certain tensions between them. But Rabbi Tal had a very simple formula. Their importance, the order of their significance, is in order of their emergence upon the scene. The first to come into existence is, of course, the people of Israel, which, as it were, comes into existence in Egypt. Right? I'm reading Shemot at the moment. The Jewish people, crucially, is born outside of the land of Israel. Only afterwards do they receive the Torah, the Sinai. Sinai is not just Sinai, but Sinai is not Israel. Only afterwards do they come into Israel, in the land of Israel. And the idea, the ordering, the precedence which needs to be ascribed to them is in that order. The land of Israel is certainly a very dear, very cherished idea throughout Jewish history, past and present, but it has to give way to the Torah of Israel. And the Torah of Israel itself has to give way to the people of Israel. And I hope at this stage we can see some of the lines that will connect with Amital's broader religious and spiritual worldview to what are going to be some of his political ideas. Perhaps just to sum a couple of them up, which stem from these sources. Rabbi Tal was often wont to say, "Lo hakol halacha." This is not irreverent. Everybody does this who knew Rabbi Tal. He would rather say, "Lo hakol halacha." That was maybe a very good one. A sort of Hungarian Russian accent in his Hebrew. Not everything is halacha. Halacha, remember, he's talking to a yeshiva audience. He's not talking to an audience that wants to be convinced that not everything is halacha. It's easy to find them. It was very important for him to to say that. And rather, I'd rephrase Rav Amital in saying what he himself said, to say, Lo hakol, not everything is. Rav Amital was very opposed to putting all of his value eggs, as it were, in a single basket. Lo hakol halacha, lo hakol eretz Yisrael. Not everything is halacha, not everything is the land of Israel. And I think perhaps the personal lesson that I try to take from this as a student of his is, how did Rav Amital do it? To be in love with something, to be besotted with something. He was besotted with Judaism, besotted with the land of Israel, but yet nevertheless not allow that obsession, that deep, deep adoration, to spill into a complete myopia when it comes to the rest of the world around him. How to nevertheless keep things in perspective. That is the one idea which will move into his politics. And the second one, which might have just been latent, but I think comes under the surface, is the idea of Chilul Hashem, the desecration of God's name. To cut a very long historical concept very short and give it its immediate representation, Rav Amital's thought, Hashem, as it were, the God of Israel, is represented in this world by the people of Israel. If bad happens to the people of Israel, or bad is caused by the people of Israel, that is the creation of the desecration of God's name, one of the most important or terrible values of Judaism. And the ultimate desecration of God's name, of course, was the Holocaust. That ultimate event which is in the background to all this. But if you like the story of hearing the babies cry, the story of not pushing aside clear, obvious ethical morals at the expense of other values, all stems from a single desire for Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name in the world. And with that, let's move into the reason I'm sure many people came to this session, an alternative religious Zionism. And with this, we need to step back from the immediate context somewhat. And the way I want to try and do this, I hope I can, is to, as it were, sketch the intellectual history of religious Zionism almost in the abstract, almost, not quite, but almost disconnected from specific historical political events, and then reinsert those events later on in the story to understand how they play out. I mentioned Professor Ravitsky at the beginning of this. Professor Ravitsky, for those of you not familiar with him, one of the great modern Jewish minds. He was head of Jewish philosophy at Hebrew U until a few years ago, when very, very tragically he was hit by a bus in Jerusalem and became a shadow of his former academic self. His book on religious Zionism, it's called, it's quite a mouthful, Messianism, Zionism, and Jewish Religious Radicalism, is, in my opinion, the book on Judaism's response to Zionism. So I'm going to use part of his formulation. When Zionism, let's call it Herzl Zionism, burst onto the scene, it presented a dual challenge to traditional Judaism. On the one hand, as I mentioned at the start, the leadership of the Jewish people had always been by the religious. Now, there had been Jews in the past who had wanted to leave Judaism, who wanted to assimilate, that was one thing. But there hadn't been secular assimilated Jews in the past that actually wanted to take over the reins of the Jewish people. That was a major, major challenge. The second challenge was a, if you like, a much more theological one. The classic, basic theological model of exile and redemption was the Jews wait passively in the diaspora, waiting for God to lift them up on the wings of eagles and take them back to the land of Israel when the time would come. They were not supposed to do anything in order to forward this themselves. There'd been certain eccentrics, certain false messiahs who had tried to do this. But Zionism represented a major, major rebellion in trying to, the phrase is, to force the end, as it were. This is the challenge that Zionism creates for Judaism. So some elements of religious Jewry, Orthodox Jewry, take the rather obvious approach, which is to completely reject Zionism. And we're all familiar with that, so we're not going to talk about that now. What's of our interest, though, is how does religious Zionism emerge? Zionism, which is this great challenge to Judaism, how does it somehow become part of Judaism? So the first approach, and this develops really around the time that Herzl and the First Zionist Congress is really getting going, There's one that people these days really aren't that familiar with, quite tragically. It's probably best associated with the name of a man called Rabbi Rhines, who was very involved with the Mizrahi movement. It perhaps might also be involved with the Netziv, the head of the Varoshin Yeshiva, Talmud Studio of Berlin. His son changed his name to Bar Ilan and came to the University of Bar Ilan. Slightly, maybe not quite as much with the Netziv. But the first way in which Jewish religious Orthodox figures made Zionism kosher, as it were, was to say Zionism has got nothing to do with Judaism. Zionism is simply about improving the lot of Jews. We are a poor, battered, persecuted people living in Europe. Obviously, this is all very Ashkenazi-focused, as Ashkenazi-centric as the early period of Zionism is. Right? Hatikva is always, looked to the east for 2,000 years. Well, not all Jews have looked to the east, so different direction. Anyway, of course, Zionism didn't see that. But the first way in which Orthodox Jews can say Zionism is okay, it's got nothing to do with Judaism. It's only about improving the lot. It wants to make us feel better. It wants to give us some element of political security, protect us from persecution. How on earth can we be opposed to that? And so Zionism is legitimated by casting as having nothing whatsoever to do with Judaism. Therefore, it may come as a surprise, there is plenty of early religious Zionist support for the Uganda plan, because the Uganda plan fits perfectly with this conception. If Zionism is just about improving a lot of the Jews, then if Uganda's willing to house us, then why not? And fascinatingly, the real opposition to the Uganda plan is from the mainstream of the secular Zionist body. That is a fascinating story in itself, which we're going to leave for now due to constraints of time. Of course, the key figure in the story is a name you'll all be familiar with, we've mentioned him already, and that is Rav Kook. And Rav Kook, although becomes extremely popular and absolutely internalized as the figure of religious Zionism, is very controversial at the start of his life. He writes his first major work in 1901. He's in London, he moves to Israel, he's in London during the First World War. He then moves back to Israel, he's chiefly a rabbi of Yafo, and then becomes the first chief rabbi of Palestine. And he does the exact opposite move to his religious Zionist predecessors. Whereas Rabbi Rhines and his cohort said Zionism is kosher because it's got nothing to do with Judaism, Rav Kook said Zionism is kosher because it is Judaism. It absolutely is Judaism. Zionism for Rav Kook does not start in 1948, does not start in 1897. Rather, Zionism starts with the destruction of the Second Temple, or I go even further back, but Zionism properly starts with the creation of the world. Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning, God creates the heaven and the earth, and Zionism is in the DNA of it. The secular Zionists might not realize this. They probably don't realize this. They are they have an internal spark inside them which is prompting them to do this in Rav Kook's theology. But really what we are seeing is Zionism is part of a far, far longer historical process which is going on. It's part of returning the Jews to their homeland, part of, in fact, really is part of a far, not just something to do with Jewish people, it's part of a universal period of sort of messianism which is going on at this time. It's very important to understand that Rav Kook did the major bulk of his writings during and after the First World War, when Rav Kook was not alone at all in seeing the First World War as the war to end all the wars, the final last gasp of fallen humanity, of disgusting humanity, which wishes to slaughter one another for corrupt purposes, before eventually mankind will come to the realization that this is not how to live. President Woodrow Wilson more or less shares the same idea in a far more secularized way, but this is very much what's imbuing Rav Kook. It's probably worth reading this source book to really understand this idea. I've called it Rav Kook's Revolution, Purification Through Exile. What has been the role of the exile in this book? It's from one of his major works of Orlot. Sorry, I've got a really dry voice. So that would anybody with a loud voice, loud and clear voice, like to read this for me? Stop you having to listen to my voice. So I know you're all ex-youth movement people. You're all doing it. Thank you, David.
We were forced to leave the international political stage, although there was an inner desire that we'd do so until the glorious time when it would be possible to conduct a government without evil or barbarism. This is the era for which we long. Our souls have been sickened by the terrible crimes of governments during evil times. But now the time has come. Very soon, the world will sweeten, and we will be able to prepare ourselves for it will already be possible for us to conduct our government on the foundations of goodness, wisdom, uprightness, and clear divine illumination. It is not worthy for the nation of Israel to involve itself in government so long as governing has to be full of bloodshed, while governing requires skill and evildoing. The sin of the murderers, wicked kings of the earth, and all the evildoers of the land has been completed. The earth cannot achieve atonement for the blood spilt upon it, except through the blood of the one who shed it. The atonement must come, a general elimination of all the present-day cultural machines, with all their falsehood and trickery, with all their awful filth and venom. This entire culture, which exalts itself in infinite falsehood, must, by necessity, be annihilated from the world, and in its place will emerge a kingdom of the sacred and exalted. The light of Israel will appear to establish the world with people of a new spirit.
Thank you. Stop there. No. I could have chosen a number of sources. I chose this one partly because it's sort of so full, so laden. You can see, I mean, the word Israel only actually appears right at the end. The world has gone wrong for Habakkuk, has gone very, very wrong. And this is part of a much larger theological view of the world and mankind coming to a very terrible, terrible place. The last gasp of dark forces before the emergence of a new light. And it seems I have not, maybe I misfound this, or maybe I just didn't hear it. The continuation of this says, a new light will emerge. Israel will be at the centre of this. Very soon the world will sweeten. That is a key idea, a key phrase. The world is getting better. Zionism is our particular Jewish story of how this is occurring. But this is at the centre of a far, far wider process. And in turn, of course, this is God's long-term plan. In turn of this, and as part of this, is his view of the state of Israel. Do you want to carry on, David?
An ideal state, one that has the highest of all ideals engraved in its being, the most sublime happiness of the individual. This shall be our state, the state of Israel, the pedestal of God's throne in this world, for its only aim shall be that the Lord be acknowledged as one, and his name as one, which is truly the highest happiness.
Thank you. If ever you see in modern-day religious Zionist discourse, in the non-Rabbinical religious Zionist world, this sort of love, and love is definitely the wrong word actually, this adoration, exaltation of the state, capital S, capital Mem, block script Mem, as it were. The state, in this sense, does not mean the Justice Department, it does not mean the Foreign Ministry, it's an idea, a far wider idea, people are interested in the philosophical backdrop. It's very much Hegel's idea of the state. The state is the embodiment of future progress, representing the will of the nation. It almost becomes in the abstract. This explains how modern religious Zionists can say in a single breath, we are the community that the state has hurt more than anybody else, you know, this corrupt government, this leftist government, this government that wants to take us back to Auschwitz, but yet we nevertheless continue working for the state, which is our highest goal, because there's a distinction here between the state as actual politics of people, which they don't like that much, and the state as this idea of representing sort of this redemptive messianic process. There's a wonderful Gemara, which you might expect me to bring up at this point, to jump back 1,800 years, but I think it's incredibly illuminating at this point. Our question is essentially, let me phrase it like this. To what extent do you consider your politics and your theology to be one? To what extent do you read your religious theological views about what the world is about onto political, historical, social events going on in front of you? Does it bother me if the two are out of sync with one another? Should my ultimate aim be to bring them as one with one another? There's this lovely Gemara, which appears in Masechet Chagiga, Tractate Chagiga, where it quotes two verses from the book of Daniel. Now, if anybody has ever opened the book of Daniel, it is a highly confusing book, apart from the first opening story. Most of it's written in Aramaic. I'm not going to read the Aramaic. It's very, if you like, it's one of the few messianic, maybe the only messianic book of the Bible. And the question of the Gemara is seemingly a very simple one. In these two verses, two different thrones are mentioned. Now the question is, what do these thrones refer to? So, the second line, halfway, five words into the second line. It's not a problem, the fact that there are two thrones mentioned. This is not a contradiction. Kudatanya, as is taught, Echad Lula, one is for him, meaning God, the throne of God. Ve'echad David, and one is for the house of David, which is, as it were, the symbol of Jewish monarchy, of power, Jewish power in this world. Divrei Rabbi Akiva. This is what Rabbi Akiva said. Amaro Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, said Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, Akiva, right? Dispensing with any polite phrase of Rabbi at the start. And he says this wonderful line, Ad matai ata oseh shchinah chol. Until when will you stop, or when will you continue making the divine, making God, making religion chol? When will you stop making it secular? When will you stop bringing it down into this world? How on earth can you say the throne of God, the throne of David, to read the two as one and together? I have my theology, I have my beliefs, and I have what is going on in the world in front of me. And it's a complex interplay between them, if there isn't an interplay at all. It is very dangerous, Rabbi Akiva, and remember Rabbi Akiva supported the Bar Kokhba uprisings, was very much saw Bar Kokhba as the Messiah, as it were, very much read his theology of needing to bring back the temple onto specific political events going on around them. And this question, the reason I bring this source up is I hope that this is exactly the argument between Rav Kook and Rav Reinz. When we look at Zionism, to what extent do we read Zionism, this political movement in the late 19th, early 20th century, as an expression of what our religion is about? Has it got nothing to do with it whatsoever, as Rav Reinz thought, as presumably Rabbi Yossi HaGalili would have thought? Or does it have absolutely everything to do with it, as Rav Kook thought, and as Rabbi Akiva presumably would have thought? This is the backdrop to the start, the early days of religious Zionism. And Rav Kook becomes the real powerhouse behind it. Now, Rav Kook thought that, and what we've read says, that very soon, in the aftermath of World War I, the world will sweeten. The world will become a better place, and Zionism has its role in this. However, as we all know, Rabbi Kook died in 1930, the world did not sweeten.
1935.
Oh, sorry, thank you. Rabbi Kook died in 1935. At least, crucially, it's before 1939. It's before 1944. Rabbi Kook died before the Holocaust. He did not see, as we did see, that the world did not sweeten. In fact, it got an awful lot less sweet. So what happens when your beliefs contradict what is happening in front of you? When your philosophy contradicts what is clear history in front of you? Of course, you have two options. Either reread the history that's going on in front of you, say that what it seems to be happening actually is something else, or tinker with your philosophy. And this is exactly the division, the distinction that happens. We're not going to dwell on this. It's a very distressing source. I assume most people in this room won't identify with it. Some may. I'm not bringing it in order to criticise it. I'm bringing it in order to show it as the logical extension of this. This is Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, Rav Kook's son. In 1973, speaks of the Holocaust, of the death of 6 million Jews, as the essential last need to rid the Jewish people of the dross of the diaspora before they could come into full fruition in the land of Israel. The blood of 6 million represents a substantial excision from the body of the nation. God's people had clung so determinedly to the impurity of foreign lands that when the end had arrived, they had to be cut away with a great shedding of blood. This cruel excision reveals our real life, the rebirth of the nation and the land, the rebirth of the Torah and all that is holy. The Holocaust, which of course for the vast majority of us represents the most terrible, traumatic, tragic event in Jewish history, for Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, and it follows on from his father's philosophy. Not to say that his father would have thought this, that we certainly cannot know. We don't know what Rav Kook would have thought had he lived to see the Holocaust. But it certainly follows on from it that the Holocaust is the last gasp of this. When World War I is actually just the penultimate stage, the Holocaust is the ultimate stage prior to the emergence of the state of Israel, prior to this real, true messianic part. It was the last amputation that needed to be done before the whole body could be done. And it makes a lot of sense within the context. Rav Amital, our hero, Moriba Rabbi, took a different approach. Rav Amital's phrase was essentially this. Rav Amital definitely never ever rejected Rav Kook. Rav Kook's writings had nourished him throughout his time during the war. But Rav Amital described Rav Kook as a giant and described himself as a dwarf on the shoulders of a giant. He can see that little bit further than Rav Kook was able to see. Did the world get sweeter? No, it certainly didn't. Was the world rid of corruption? Absolutely not. Does Israel, the Jewish state, represent this perfect, ideal, moral, completely uncorrupt place without social division, without inequality? L'tzareinu, to our sorry, it clearly very much does not represent this place. We're short for time, so I won't read Source 10, but effectively, Source 10 very much sums this up. And for Rav Amital, and this is the point we're really, the crucial point to get, Rav Amital, without rejecting Rav Kook, has to recast the relationship between what it means for Zionism to be part of God's plan and immediate, imminent redemption. Rather, redemption is a far more complex process, a far more nuanced process. It's a much longer road. It is certainly not immediate. And the end did not happen in 1948. 1948 was certainly only the beginning of a long road with which we have to deal with. Religious Zionism then is not coterminous with land, with every single possible inch of the land of Israel which we can establish ourselves in. Rather, it has to be to do with creating a far better, far more equal society. I see we're short on time, so perhaps I will skip to source number 14 and then perhaps cut back. And this, I think, sums it up. This is, if you like, to simplify and to put it in a short chunk, this is the alternative religious Zionism. Religious Zionism which has to recognize the religious significance of the state of Israel, at the same time as not give everything to it, be alert to the clear realities in front of us. Unlike the Haredim, we will not undermine the importance or legitimacy of the state. But our love for our country must not blind us from criticizing its shortcomings. We remain very, very far from the ideal Jewish state, and we must therefore do whatever we can to bring about its realization. A more just society and stronger public values are necessary prerequisites for its actualization. If we want to hasten the ultimate redemption, we must work hard to ensure moral values on both the individual and communal levels, closing the social gaps, concern for the vulnerable elements of society, fighting poverty, respectful treatment of the non-Jews in Israel. All these measures will bring us closer to the day for which we long. We hope and believe that our state will develop into the ideal Jewish state, the foundation of the divine throne in the world, whose entire desire is that God shall be one and his name shall be one. But it's certainly nowhere near that stage yet, and indeed that is what our world has to do. Religious Zionism now moves away from being an imminent messianic model to, I understand it as, the bridge between what it means to be Jewish and what it means to be Israeli, not wishing to convert anyone by any means, but really feeling that we have a need, an urgent need, to strive for a better society. The bits we've skipped out can be read by yourselves. They sum it up well. His response to the assassination of Rabin, Chief Rabbi Jacobitz's great delight at finding somebody like him during the tumultuous 1980s. If I can just end with just a personal story, which I think has wider application. About a year and a half ago, I approached Rav Amital, and I had a personal problem. It was an important issue, a sensitive issue for me to discuss, which I needed some guidance on. I was torn between two different directions, two very seemingly incommensurable options, and I went to him with this problem. And after talking to someone through with me, he simply said what has been perhaps the most important words he's ever said to me. Just three very simple words. Tiyek tzak optimisti. Be a little bit optimistic. Don't view everything as so terribly caught between them. And I think that, for me, that's very much his message, and one which hopefully he will be able to bequeath to us way beyond his actual years on this earth, that we shouldn't all be so down, but be rather optimistic about what we do have and realise the work we still need to do. Thank you.